Good morning and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour for your delightful Monday morning, February 23rd, 2015. Good morning and welcome to another edition of the Radical Leftist Feminist Marxist Queer Thought and Analysis from your favorite agitators at the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Ivan Hale, and Patsy Kohlberg is the esteemed engineer. We come to you live and otherwise each week to provide information, commentary, interviews, music, poetry, and prose that speak to the underdog, the working class, the marginalized, the exploited. We talk about bringing down structures that serve to empower only the elite while crushing the hands of the proletariat, tethering us tighter to the cogs of the capitalist machine. We live in a world of never-ending wars, remote-controlled weapons, militarized police, and the relentless gunning down of unarmed citizens, where our planet is changing under the shifting weight of unregulated corporations, societies taught to find happiness through accumulation, and the unmitigated need for more, bigger, better, faster. The Old Mole is a collective because we know what happens here happens everywhere. A bomb exploding in Paris is a drone strike in Pakistan, is the murder of a black man by police, is the rape of a woman, is the oppression of Palestine by Israel, is the homeless, is the mentally ill, is the incarcerated, is the suffering of all humanity. It will be through our collective consciousness that peace will be achieved, that freedom from suffering will be known. Today, on our show, senior analyst Bill Resnick talks with Craig Morris about Renewables International and the example of Germany's energy policy. Joe Clement will be reading from Alison Hope Alcon's Black, White, and Green Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. And lastly, movie moles Fran Michel and Denise Morris will review A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, a movie that is probably not what you might think it is. Stay tuned.
Craig Morris, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Morris is a U.S. citizen. He's living and writing from Germany for the last 23 years. He's probably done more than any other journalist to bring to public attention the phenomenal success of Germany in moving away from coal and nuclear energy towards renewables, particularly solar and wind. Indeed, Germany, more than any other country, has shown the way to become virtually carbon-free, that is, free of greenhouse gas emissions. And the way they've done that, with a large and growing sector of locally produced energy and the development of local grids and networks, the way they've done that is demonstrates not only how to save humanity from global warming, and that's not an overstatement, it seems to me, but also how to democratize modern politics. Though, of course, those threatened by democracy have recognized the threat and are now trying to stop the Germans' progress that is redirected towards corporate control. Craig Morris, tell us first about the German energy Wende, how it happened, how it was implemented.
Well, it starts off in the 1970s, basically as a movement of citizens trying to block big infrastructure projects that were going to disrupt their communities. I suppose the closest equivalent that we would have in the States to that right now is the pushback against shale projects in some communities. So you have to imagine that these communities, like a number of the towns in the States that are voting against shale companies, the Germans were saying they didn't want to have nuclear coming in and industrializing their environment. They might have gotten a little bit of kickback, but the real profits would have gone to some big out-of-town companies. And whatever risks were involved, they were going to have to run them with their livelihoods. Nobody was going to pay them if anything went wrong. And so really I see a lot of connections there between those two movements, the pushback against shale and the pushback against in the States today, and the pushback against nuclear in Germany started going back to the 70s.
How did that then develop into the Energiewende?
Well, the citizens then began asking themselves, if we're saying no to nuclear, what are we saying yes to? And that led to a movement where a lot of people developed small wind turbines in their garages, then founded small companies. These were engineers who quit their jobs and got together with some friends and started to just make bigger and bigger systems. And it's kind of funny that out of all this, we think today maybe the turbines that we see are by firms like GE. Actually, GE got into the game very late. They took over a German firm, partly, and that's also what Siemens did, the big, you know, German industrial giant, a very late comer to the game of wind power. So the big players sat there doing nothing while a lot of small new startups started making turbines. They worked well. They kept developing them. And by the time they got really big, the big guys were able to come in and buy them up. And that's the way the citizens really pushed a brand new industry. And something similar also happened with photovoltaics, where Shell and BP were actually in solar just 15 years ago, roughly, left right about the time that things started to take off, and now they're not really players anymore, and the whole thing has sort of gone to China, really. But it was a lot of German companies that not so much developed the technology, but began deploying it on a wide scale, began building the first big projects. And some of them have also been taken over by the Chinese, actually by the Koreans in the case of Qcells. Qcells was once the biggest solar cell manufacturer. So it's a German firm historically, and it's now wholly owned by a South Korean sort of conglomerate.
Mm-hmm. And it was German engineers and German installers and local governments who also pioneered the networking, the local networking of small installations, is my understanding.
Right. It's very much been a push by citizens and by small businesses competing with the big guys. Whether or not that's going to continue, you know, over the next 30 years or so till mid-century is a different question. But it's very much up to now been very vitalizing for rural communities, for struggling communities. It's just really redistributed the wealth geographically. So Germany's economy right now is the best that it's been since reunification at the beginning of the 90s. We've got, I think, something like 5% unemployment, but, you know, you can look up the exact figure. But it's a very strong economy right after 25 years of this push towards renewables. So people who say, well, it's going to cost us jobs and everything, Germany really doesn't show that.
Tell us the role of the feed-in tariff. How did it develop, and why was it so important in contributing and facilitating the development of all that local energy?
Well, if you go back to, let's say, the 90s in Germany, or even in most of the states, it's even this way today, you have regulated monopolies. You know, your power provider in most parts of the states, even today, is a monopoly that is regulated by politicians, and people are not able to pick and choose where they want to get their power from. So a couple of decades ago, the Germans said, well, what you've basically got is these companies can make investments, and then they present the bill to the regulators and say, well, we had to build this to want this kind of profit margin on top of that, so here's the power price. And they negotiated that with the regulators, and if the regulators thought the books were in order, then they said, okay, you can charge that price. And so the first campaigners for photovoltaics and for wind went to the government and said, well, why don't you give us that for the wind and the solar panels?
Give us the same price, that the big energy companies were getting.
No. It wasn't. That's a real distinction to make here. Initially, you're right. Initially, they did actually get something like net metering. So they got sort of a price that was relative to the household rate, the retail rate. But eventually, they've developed that further and said, well, you know, why don't we make a clear distinction here? What does a kilowatt hour of electricity from a wind turbine cost if I build it right and I put it in a good location? And what's a small profit margin on top of that? So give us like 5 or 6% profit on top of that. And that'll be the price that you pay. And we'll make sure that, you know, you don't give us an upfront bonus. If the thing doesn't work, you know, we don't get any money. We only get money if we actually produce the power. And so it's our responsibility to make sure that these machines work and produce as much electricity as possible at a given site. And you just guarantee us a price that will give us the kind of security, investment security, that the conventional sector has had all along. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big difference in thinking, was that these campaigners were essentially saying, you're guaranteeing a profit for these monopoly utilities, regulated monopoly utilities, give that to citizens as well, and we will actually push through this revolution. And just to point out how profitable the sector has been and how guaranteed these profits were, RWE just posted its first loss last year since World War II. So they have actually been profitable for more than half of a century, 60-something years.
That's the big German electric utility.
That is one of the big two, actually.
Right.
We talk about the big four over here, but RWE vies for top position along with another one called E.ON. And so this is the biggest energy company, electricity company over here, a very big coal company, by the way. And because of these guaranteed profits, they've never been in the red since the country was founded after the war.
What we haven't discussed yet is, of course, the incredibly important increase in sun and wind energy and renewable energy in Germany. Now, apparently, close to 30% of Germany's energy usage is satisfied by renewables. Is that right? And much of that is the result of the feed-in tariff.
Well, yes, it is the result of the feed-in tariff. I would just make sure that we make a distinction between energy and electricity.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about energy, we're talking about the fuel we put in our cars as well. And, of course, that's, you know, gasoline and diesel over here like it is pretty much everywhere else. And we're also talking about heat in homes. That's another big chunk of the pie.
Right. I meant electricity, the amount of electricity used.
Right. Heat in homes and industry is actually, those things are actually bigger than electricity. But, yes, we get 30% roughly, I think it was 31% of our electricity from green sources. That was the statistic last year, I believe. And really, feed-in tariffs have driven that by giving, you know, allowing citizens to have these investments that are relatively safe at a modest profit margin, and that's really driven this revolution. At the same time, just to come back to what you said at the beginning of the show, you know, is Germany a leader and the best example? I would actually argue that it's not. It's a very interesting story, and it does do one thing fantastically well, and I hope we get to that. But let me just briefly say, Denmark is further than Germany. If you look at what Denmark is doing, it's actually more interesting in terms of its performance and in terms of its goals. And then some people would also say, well, you know, we should look at countries like Brazil have an even higher share of green electricity. And I'm a little more skeptical of that simply because we cannot copy the example that countries like Brazil and even Austria set, because they use so much hydro and biomass, and they have relatively small populations for the area that we're talking about. And so Germany simply can't decide to turn on the Amazon River to generate power. But what Germany is doing is replicable. So, in fact, it's not only replicable, everybody else can probably even do it better than Germany. Germany's going solar and going wind with relatively poor solar and wind resources. So if Germany can go 30% and about, I think it was about 13% was just wind and solar last year, then that shows you that the rest of the world can probably fairly easily double that. And, of course, Germany's not going to stop at 13% solar and wind. In fact, we plan to go 80% renewable electricity by mid-century, and pretty much all of that growth at this point will be solar and wind, because we're running out of future potential for hydro and biomass.
And it seems to me, though, electricity can be and is now moving around the world much too slowly. Electricity is certainly the future of transport. That is the energy source for transport. All maybe but airplanes. It seems to me that once we develop solar and wind sufficiently, we can reduce the transport's percentage of greenhouse gas emissions by an enormous amount. And Germany is also, which we don't have time to talk about, has probably gone as far as any other country. Maybe Denmark is ahead of it, but Denmark's a lot smaller. But in pioneering technologies of home heating and cooling that use very little energy. I mean, it's quite remarkable, some of the experiments, but I wish we could get into it. We can't in this show. Let me reintroduce you, Craig Morris, and then we'll talk about local energy and some of the cities in Germany and around the world that have pioneered not corporate energy, but local community dispersed energy. Craig Morris is an American writer living in Germany who writes about energy, and especially the enormous impact and success of Germany's energy policy called the Energiewende. Craig Morris, talk about local energy and some of the cities that have gone furthest.
Well, you said at the outset that Germany has done two things. Well, one of them was fighting climate change, and the other was democratizing energy. And I just said, actually, that other countries are also doing at least as good, if not better, in combating climate change. But nobody's doing better than Germany at democratizing energy production. And this is probably a new concept to a lot of your listeners. So let me explain what that is. Essentially, you have the right to make your own energy. It's not, you know, in the Bill of Rights, but it's also not prohibited anywhere. And what's happening right now is that people are getting these technologies that allow them to make their own energy in various ways, and they're pushing back against the electricity that is coming from the grid from the big players. So because this is now becoming a profitable way and a reliable way of making your own energy yourself, this is a threat to the conventional energy sector. Farmers practically all over the world, in Germany and in the States and other countries, up into the 1940s, they would actually put up their own wind generators if they wanted to have electricity because the grid had not been expanded. If you've read Animal Farm by George Orwell,
you may
remember that the animals are actually planning to build a wind generator, and it's not to grind grain, it's to generate electricity. And that was written in, 1944. And so the concept back then was very common to everyone, familiar to everyone, and we sort of lost that.
And farmers' cooperatives, not just individual farmers, although many were
individual,
but people got together to create energy.
Exactly. And so what we have today is far more opportunities and options than we had in the 1940s. The largest turbine in the world, it's like 140 meters tall. It has 7.5 megawatts, which probably won't mean much to your listeners, but it's about three times more powerful than the standard unit that's being built right now. Some of the first ones that were built over here in Germany were actually put up by community projects. So if you can get 100 people to pitch in something like 5,000 euros per person at least, you're already looking at hundreds of thousands of euros with which you can leverage another loan that's much bigger. And that's kind of the way the thinking goes over here. You come up with a third of the money as equity, and then you leverage the other two as a loan, and suddenly you're talking about projects worth millions, and you can do these things that are industrial in size. So we have projects over here driven largely by individual investors, by small businesses, and by these groups that come together, these energy cooperatives, and they are leveraging millions of euros to put up several wind turbines at a time, and then they call these things their own, right? And they'll also put up a biogas unit, and they'll put up some solar, and they design this the way they want it, so they don't perceive these projects as coming in from out of town, and they have town meetings, and everybody gets to say what they want, and sometimes they go from five turbines to three because some people are too worried. And then the people see that the three turbines are okay, and maybe they build the other two that they wanted a few years later after everybody's comfortable.
Yeah, and solar, though, solar gives very little discomfort except for some aesthetic things. It seems to me small solar really works as well in cities.
In cities, of course, yes. But I mean, the vision over here is not so much that Berlin will generate, 100% of its energy within the city limits.
Right.
Just as Berlin doesn't get its food from within the city limits. So you are going to have cities sort of tapping the potential of surrounding areas for energy just as we do for food today.
But you don't need a huge grid. One of the great money-saving factors is you can build it very close to the city, and the larger installations and the billions and trillions of dollars that would be necessary for carrying electricity for hundreds and thousands of miles, that just wouldn't happen.
Right, and the funny thing about the debate that we're having now, you know, you may have read in the paper somewhere that what Germany's doing is going to cost whatever amount because they need grid upgrades. Well, the joke, of course, is that we have gone from 4% renewable energy 20 years ago to 30% today, and we have not had grid upgrades. So, yes, at some point, you need to have some minor grid upgrades, just as you start producing more power where you didn't have it before. But we've added a quarter green electricity without having to modify the grid at all.
This is K-Radio, KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on your dial. Bill Resnick talking to Craig Morris. Tell us about the way in which the local energy networks operate to also move towards tremendous energy reduction in transport, in heating and cooling homes, even in towards local agriculture, ways of conserving energy. And the local networks work much better in reducing energy use than the big utilities who send a notice along with their bills telling people to turn off the lights. What's necessary in stopping global warming is stopping all fossil fuel use, and those local energy networks have an enormous role in doing that.
Well, what you have to do is at some point take out the profit motive from sales of power. If your power company only sees power sales as a way of being profitable, then they will actually oppose efficiency and conservation. And this is part of the reason why we simply need to have new companies involved as providers so that we have people who are going to facilitate investments in insulating homes, in maybe switching from fossil fuels to electric mobility. But also you're going to need a city government that is, especially for transportation, that is willing to make cities more walkable, more cyclable, provide more urban transportation. From what I've seen in the States, there are some cities that are doing pretty well, but if you go over to a city like Amsterdam or Copenhagen or even Freiburg, where I live in Germany, it kind of blows your mind if you haven't seen it before. The bicycle autobahns they have, the highways they have, so that cyclists can just ride straight through town past the cars that are stopped at stoplights, special bridges and underpasses and things like that that are made for the bikes. This is the kind of thinking that we need. It has to be more holistic, and that just requires a commitment from city government and an understanding. The people have to accept it when it comes. They have to have it explained to them, but the city officials also have to be behind it and really own it.
Portland, Oregon is a perfect city for that, but that's a whole other matter. Craig Morris, thanks so much for talking to us today.
I was glad to be here.
Freaky deaky people, I want to teach you a dance, a lady rapper dance. Can I have any cast members who choose, who wish to touch me during the dance phases? Ring a dang dang. Who's got that thing? Don't touch me. Are we going to thrust from the hips? We go bow wow. That's what the dogs say at the pound. They're like, hey, lady, where you going? Can I touch your microphone? I say no, switch sides. Okay? Now we're going to check the clocks. What time is it? I got to go to a movie, and the matinee is cheaper. I better put my beeper to beats. Hey, lady, what's that? Is that a saxophone or a trumpet? That's a brass band. I know that. I eat nachos. Who put the navy beans on sale? Mama's kinda hungry, and I gotta eat some beans. Don't go anywhere without your mama's help, 'cause she's got the person who knows the belts. Wear a belt when your pants get baggy. Don't be saggy. Put a flaggy on your bike, 'cause traffic wants to kill you. Hey, pothole people, don't step on that. You're gonna break your bones, big biggity bones. Tap the beat. We're gonna tap the toes. We're gonna tap the toes. We're gonna slick the hair. We're gonna order teddy bears online. Put your Beanie Babies in a Tupperware box and put them in your closet and forget about them. In 22 years, you'll be happy you did. Who here likes to jazz?
Me.
I like jazz.
Who here likes to razzes?
I like to razzes.
Who here wants to ride a Tony?
Me, me.
Who here prefers vegan bologna?
Me.
Pop, pop, pop that lock and roll. Let it ride, now let it flow. MPLS, that's your airport code. Check, check, check. Who knows ya? I do. I personalize your profile. Razzitaz.
You look good.
Summarize. The summary sketch. Look at the way he isolates. He's tone. Mama's got a hot look. Wish I had it in a scrapbook. I'd call it, who's the Chester with the cheetah hat? She's got pants.
Yeah. Wow.
Thanks.
Thanks, Leslie.
We're broken up. Thanks, guys. Really felt good.
Okay. That was Leslie and the Lies. Gosh. You know, to get the full effect of Leslie and the Lies, you really got to see her on either live or in a video, because she's amazing. That was Leslie and the Lies. She's got pants. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick and Craig Morris talking about Germany's energy policy and all of that. And up next, well, let's see. Let me read some promos today. And up next, we'll hear Air Cascadia presenting cutting-edge news, views, and interviews with Chris Andre. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is Julia DeGraw, Northwest organizer for Food and Water Watch, who has been organizing opposition to Nestle's plan to build a bottled water plant in the Columbia Gorge. What? Nestle. At 11, it's Disability Awareness with host Grace Eagle Reed, a monthly show about issues affecting people with disabilities and their communities. And at 11:30 on the Monday Morning Radio Zine, we'll hear host Andrew Geller speak with French lawmaker Laurence Abbé, the author of new legislation to protect people from radio frequency radiation. Okay, Joe Clement will now read from Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy, and how we can understand the green economy.
Last week, Tom Becker read an article about the pitfalls and perhaps inevitability of techno fixes for dealing with climate change, which made me want to share an excerpt from a book that I've been reading by Allison Hope Alcon. The book's called Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. The particular section from Chapter 2 on Understanding the Green Economy that I want to read describes the co-optation or the shift in environmentalist rhetoric and cachet and practice in the 1970s for one that was critical of capitalism and called for its constraint at the very least, if not sometimes its full-on abolition, to one that takes the capitalist economy and the market for granted as natural. In 1972, a groundbreaking study called The Limits to Growth modeled the effects of increases in population growth and resource consumption on ecological health. It concluded that if current trends continued, they would lead to, quote, overshoot and collapse, end quote, in which human societies could no longer provide for themselves. This influential report lent credence to two approaches to global development. One was the Malthusian argument against population growth, which had become popular among wealthy countries with already low growth rates. Emphasizing population without regard for consumption, however, places the burden of environmental problems entirely on the global South. Many activists seeking to preserve the natural world and increase social equity supported a second approach, zero economic growth or steady state economics. In contrast to macroeconomic policies commonly designed to produce growth, steady-state systems aim for equilibrium, or for slight fluctuations, in both population and production. According to ecological economists like Herman Daly, a steady-state economy does not excessively disrupt natural ecosystems and can protect natural resources. The limits to growth argument was highly controversial. Among its most prominent critics was Columbia University economist Jagdish Bhagwati. In a widely read article in Scientific American from 1993, Bhagwati argued that economic growth would protect the environment, as profits garnered could be taxed and used for the abatement of pollution and for general remediation. To support this position, he pointed to the high numbers of environmental organizations in developed countries with high economic growth, arguing that growth is good for the environmental movement and hence good for the environment itself. Extending his argument in 2009, Bhagwati accounts for social goods as well, arguing that, quote, firms that make losses can't finance corporate social responsibility policies, end quote. Present-day proponents of the green economy similarly argue that economic growth leads to environmental protection. The idea that there were environmental limits to economic growth greatly influenced the U.S. environmental movement in the 1970s, which departed from its preservationist predecessor to advocate state cleanup and control of pollution. This is not to say that some environmentalists were not closely tied to environmental movement in the 1970s, which departed from its preservationist predecessor to advocate state cleanup and control of pollution. This is not to say that some environmentalists were not closely tied to environmental pollution. The pollution industry sponsored the carbon tax, carbon pollution, 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 carbon pollution passed legislation that would constrain profits, reflecting a popular belief that environmental and human health limits to economic growth were sometimes necessary. At the same time, more radical environmentalists developed currents of environmental theory and practice that offered implicit and explicit critiques of industrial culture and sometimes of capitalism itself. Eco-socialists, eco-feminists, and social ecologists argued that domination of nature was a consequence of domination between people and had found its most quote-unquote exacerbating development under capitalism. Advocates of these positions called for collective ownership of the means of production and the restoration of the commons. In addition, deep ecologists, who prioritized the intrinsic worth of non-human nature, emphasized its protection over economic growth. Their best-known strategy consists of direct action tree sits, in which activists occupy land slated to be logged in order to protect it. Additionally, while a confrontation with capitalism was not always at the top of the agenda for the Back to the Land movement, it attempted to escape the cultural and economic constraints of, quote, mainstream society, end quote, through the creation of rural communes in which resources could be shared. These communes developed some of the early techniques that would enable organic farming and are an important predecessor for many today's food movements and farmers' markets. Participants in this kind of environmentalism advocated the creation of new, non-capitalist ways of being that they envisioned as close to and respectful of non-human nature. Despite their sometimes fiercely argued differences, these voices saw capitalism as something to escape from or confront if the environment and human society were to be sustained. The popularity of environmental discourses arguing for limits on capitalism, quote, came to represent a substantial and growing constraint on capitalist accumulation strategies and thus was ripe for neoliberal attacks. McCarthy and Prudhomme write in 2004 about neoliberal nature and the nature of neoliberalism. These attacks occurred in the wake of the late 1970s energy crisis, which made it difficult to argue against growth and helped propel the Reagan administration's pro-business and anti-environment agenda. In this context, the state abandoned its charge of protecting citizens from the excesses of capital, instead imagining its role as the creator of market conditions favorable to growth. In this reactionary political landscape, sustainability emerged as a discourse that could guide economic and cultural practices, fitting environmentalists' concern into a pro-growth agenda. Environmental activists began to ignore the role of capitalism in environmental degradation, paving the way for a new sustainability paradigm in which economic growth and environmental protection were seen as interdependent. If you just tuned in, I've been reading from Allison Hope Alcon's book, Black, White, and Green, subtitled Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. I thought that I would pair that with one of my favorite songs from the 2012 Lorax movie because of the way that it lays bare the logic of the pro-growth agenda, as Allison Hope Alcon puts it, that is behind the marriage between sustainability and capitalism. How bad can I be? I'm just doing what comes.
naturally. How bad can I be? I'm just following my destiny. How bad can I be? I'm just doing what comes naturally. How bad can I be? How bad can I possibly be? Well, there's a principle in nature, that almost every creature knows, called survival of the fittest. And check it, this is how it goes. The animal that wins gotta scratch and fight and claw and bite and punch. And the animal that doesn't, well, the animal that doesn't winds up someone else's. La 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 lunch. I'm just saying, how bad can I be? I'm just doing what comes naturally. How bad can I be? I'm just following my destiny. How bad can I be? I'm just doing what comes naturally. There's a principle in business, that everybody knows it sound. It says the people with the money, make this ever-loving world go round. So I'm bigger in my company, I'm bigger in my factory, I'm bigger in my corporate sign. Everybody out there, take care of yours and me. I'll take care of mine, 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 mine.
Shake that bottom line.
Let me say.
Hey guys.
Hello.
Hi, hello.
My name is Dana. I'll be taking care of you today. If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
Is that USDA organic or Oregon organic or Portland organic?
It's just all across the board, organic.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres. Mm-hmm. Give me just a second. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Great. She's nice.
We're doing the right thing.
I'm too apologetic.
You are.
I drove way too slow here today, didn't I?
Yeah.
I am so weird with that gas pedal. I think just moves the whole vehicle forward.
All right, so here is the chicken you'll be enjoying tonight.
You have this information. This is fantastic.
Absolutely. His name was Colin. Here are his papers, okay?
That's great. He looks like a happy little guy who runs around. A lot of friends, other chickens as friends. Putting his little wing around another one and kind of like palling around.
I don't know that I can speak to that level of intimate knowledge about him. They do a lot to make sure that their chickens are very happy.
When you say they, I mean, who are these people raising Colin?
It's a farm that's located about 30 miles south of Portland.
And you have a good relationship with this farm?
We do.
But it's not some guy on a yacht who lives in Miami.
Oh, goodness, no.
Saying that he's organic.
It tears at the core of my being the idea of someone just cashing in on a trend like organic.
No, I know the type, no.
Yeah.
Tell you what, we're gonna go check it out if you don't mind. Just if you could hold our seats.
Oh, now?
Yeah, I will be right back. Just wanna make sure.
You know, okay. Thank you so much, Dana.
Sure.
All right. That was the Colin the Chicken episode from Portlandia. We want you to feel good about the radio that you listen to here at KBOO. Before that, Joe Clement was reading from Black, White, and Green, Farmers Markets, Race, and the Green Economy. Up next, Movie Moles, Fran Michelle, and Denise Morris are going to be reviewing A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, a new film now that's playing locally. Check it out.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with Denise Morris. The Movie Moles today are not going to talk about the Oscars, except to say why we're not going to talk about them. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences was started in 1927 by studio head Louis B. Mayer to unite the different branches of the film industry. Mayer commented on the creation of the awards that, quote, "I found the best way to handle filmmakers was to hang medals all over them. If I got them cups and awards, they'd kill to produce what I wanted. That's why the Academy Award was created," end quote. This year's awards have been marked by the continuing lack of racial and gender diversity that's characteristic of the whole industry. The membership of the Academy, the group that votes for the awards, is 94% white and 77% male. Out of 127 nominees for the 2015 awards, 118 were white and 9 non-white. 102 were men with an average age of 51, and just 25 were women with an average age of 41. So instead of discussing the awards that middle-aged white men give each other in a project designed to enable producers to control workers, we're going to talk about an independent film written and directed by a young Iranian-American woman.
Directed by Anna Lily Amirpour.
A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, a Farsi-language black-and-white vampire western filmed outside Bakersfield, California, featuring a young female vampire who rides a skateboard, wears a chador, and kills sexist, abusive men.
This is going to be a much more interesting conversation, I think. I have not personally seen any of the Oscar films, and I'm going to keep it that way. We need to talk about the vampires to begin, I think. I thought that it was an interesting way to create a bridge between this old world and new world. We see that play out in a number of scenes, particularly when the girl, the vampire, is in her apartment. She's very much surrounded by symbols of modern teenage, young adult culture, the music, the pop stars, the pop culture. So, and yet her presence is very much reminiscent of that old world vampire, the Dracula vampire. One thing I wanted to point out too is the isolation and the desolate surroundings that people experience, both the isolation in terms of location, but also just the sparsity of people in this town.
Yeah, it's set in a town called Bad City, which, as people have noted in published reviews, echoes the graphic novel Sin City. As you noted, Denise, also is a little reminiscent of Badlands. We have this sort of allusions to the desolate, decaying west of America. We do see a lot of oil rigs in the background. It's a hard, rough town. There's a wide gap of inequality in wealth that we see, and we are mostly located with the impoverished, which is a little bit unusual for vampire films and vampire stories. They do traditionally align vampires with the affluent, Count Dracula with the nobility. Vampires usually are figures of wealth, perhaps going back to Marx's comments about capital as vampiristic in draining the living blood of workers in order to live the more. But in this case, it seems to go against that. She is not a particularly affluent vampire. She lives in an underground one-room apartment, as you note, wallpapered with, it looks like 80s posters and stuff. I sort of read her as having been turned into a vampire around the 80s, which is actually right after or around the period of the Iranian Revolution. So that might also be relevant to her vampirization.
And in this case, L.A. does not play itself, or Bakersfield. It actually is supposed to be an Iranian ghost town. And it's spoken in Farsi. The posters, the all writing, all there's a whole world that we who don't speak the language don't have access to here, as I said, in a lot of the visual representations, but also in the music.
Yeah, and the music is really great. But as you say, a lot of the reviewers have commented, well, it's very stylish, and it is strikingly beautiful. The cinematography is wonderful. It's in luminous black and white. It is stylishly striking looking. And critics who have commented on its lack of substance, I think, as one user of the Internet Movie Database points out, may have missed something because they are not fluent in Farsi. And that one user, Mahdi Touraj, has provided us a lot of background information. So we appreciate the information that we got from that review, pointing out a lot of the things that we would have been unaware of and that other viewers seem not to have picked up on.
Let's talk a little bit about probably the most prominent symbol in the film is the chador. And that's specific to Iran, the veil, but in this film is doubles and probably triples as many things. It's very superhero-like, but also the cape, like a Dracula cape or a vampire cape, is a very prominent piece of the costuming or the wardrobe of the girl in the film.
Yeah, it's bat wings and superhero cape and Dracula cape. and veil. It's her outer garment in which she covers herself. And I think it really turns around a lot of ideas that mainstream Western viewers have about veiling. The veil is often taken in mainstream Western culture as a simple sign of women's oppression in the Arab or Muslim or Persian world. But in fact, scholars have given very different readings of it and have put it in a much wider context. For instance, Laila Abu-Lagoud has pointed out that it's a matter of custom, and clothing is something that is always a matter of convention, or we wouldn't have people being referred to as slaves to fashion. You don't wear cut-off shorts to the opera. You wouldn't go out without your chador in certain areas. It's just not appropriate. Abu-Lagoud also points out that for people in some communities, it provides a kind of portable seclusion, giving women greater mobility in moving through the world. And the scholar Fatima Mernissi has pointed out that the comparable figures in the West might be understood as the size six. She thinks of that as the Western woman's harem or veil, that there's a kind of internalization. Instead of wearing a veil or covering yourself, you try to sculpt your body by dieting, by surgeries and constraints. And she points out that Western women try to sculpt their bodies in ways that will conform to certain standards rather than being allowed, as are women in her own country, Morocco, she says, much more understood as able to and respected for aging and growing and being big and being powerful as women.
I mean, essentially, that symbol, that clothing, becomes a symbol of power in the film. So, Fran, really at the core of this film, which has been described as the Iranian spaghetti Western, juvenile delinquent, epic, you name it, it's been called that. At its core, there's this love story. There is a young man in the film who is the James Dean type in this. And he is, in some sense, I read this as kind of an interesting critique, even if it's subtle or unintentional. Unlike in a film like Badlands, where the young woman goes off with the bad guy, who's the psychopath, and goes on a murder spree, this young man gets hooked up in a way with the woman who isn't necessarily on a murder spree, but she does have a mission.
And her mission seems to be avenging sexual violence or threats of sexual violence of various sorts. The two instances in which we see her kill someone are both cases where the men she kills are men, first of all, and have been seen abusing women in various ways. So she can be understood as a kind of figure of feminist vengeance, although the director has disavowed any sort of political claims on that score. But we don't necessarily take directors at their word. We take them at their film.
The film may perhaps be more successful at doing the very thing that the director disavows, because, we're all ideological in our way, and we bring what we have to it. And I think there's a lot there. When a person grows up in an environment like Bakersfield, but has a cultural package, as the director has, grows up American, I think there's a lot to be had there. And I think that comes through in the film. I think there's really, for me, I felt like there was an exploration of what it means to kind of somewhat come of age in an environment that is lost for dead. In the Central Valley is an incredible place to be, an incredible place to drive through. It is nowhere and everywhere. It's an important part of that state of California because of what it does in terms of agriculture and all this stuff. But there's a lot of history there, and yet there's also nothing to do, I'm sure. So it's interesting that it's placed there. I think that's not an accident. As vampire lore often says, vampires come back to the places that they were born or grew up in to somehow either reintegrate or seek vengeance.
Vampires are famous for holding onto their home soil, their home territory, for retaining that connection with the past. And that actually, as you're saying, the film draws on all sorts of different cultural representations. We could see it as a kind of vampirism of culture, just taking in everything and mixing and matching in this pastiche of the Western and the juvenile delinquent and the decaying romanticism of, or the romantic decay of American landscapes that are destroyed by the withdrawal of economic support, by the extractive technologies of oil and gas, by the appropriation of people's labor and wealth. So, I mean, it's tapping into or touching lightly on a lot of larger motifs and concerns that may be characteristic of places like Bakersfield, but also are visible in a lot of places in the United States and in a lot of places in the world.
And to speak to the director's discussion about her own upbringing, in a place like that, what you have to do is probably watch a lot of TV, a lot of movies.
As a female spectator of films, one of the things, as that same very astute user review on Internet Movie Database points out, a lot of what's going on in the film is the return of the gaze, that the girl, the unnamed vampire figure, is looking back at men who are looking in predatory ways at women. And she's returning that gaze. She's challenging their behavior. And
in fact, she says, without giving too much away, I think we've done a fair job of that, she says to a character in the film, "I will be watching you for the rest of your life." And it's probably one of the best scenes in the film, but it says a lot about the power of the gaze, as you say, the G-A-Z-E gaze, being turned around and turned back on men in that way that the male gaze is always said to be on women as you are in the film and outside of the film viewing it.
Yeah. So this film is A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, is playing at Cinema 21 in Portland. And it is one of the many places in Portland where you can see things that are not up for Oscars. You can get access to all kinds of fabulous independent films. The movie Arresting Power is going to be at the Hollywood tonight, Monday the 23rd. We've got three film festivals going on this month. One of them is still continuing. The Cascade Festival of African Films goes through March 7th. We have wonderful independent theaters here. KBOO collaborates with the Clinton Street Theater for a series of film showings there. So Portland is a great place to see movies, and we don't need to worry about those silly Oscars. For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel and Denise Morris talking about A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, currently playing in Portland.
passing of time. She's just a child. To recover a long-lasting beauty, she will die young. She's just a normal girl, dancing to her favorite song. It's time to go. Let's get on with it.
Okay. That was Fran Michel and Denise Morris reviewing A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. And the music we just heard was Farrah Dancing Girls, which is from the movie itself. So before we end the show today, I'd like to take a minute to talk about the 11, a little more somber note, the 11 trans women who have been killed so far this year in the United States. I'd like to take a minute to read the names of these 11 trans women. First, Lamar Edwards of Kentucky, age 20. Lamia Beard of Virginia, age 30. Kendra Keels of Rochester, age 20. Ty Underwood of Texas, age 24. Ashley Bell of Atlanta, age 22. Jesse Hernandez of Denver, age 17. Yasmin Payne of LA, age 33. Taja De Jesus of San Francisco, age 36. Penny Proud of New Orleans, age 21. Bree Golick of Akron, Ohio, age 22. And Christina Reinwald of Miami, age 47. It's an epidemic of sorts that we're having. And the death of several trans women so far, and it's not even March. If you want to learn more about this, you can check out the Facebook page titled Don't Kill a Trans Woman. The last week of February is dedicated to saving the lives of trans women, and it gives a list of ways that you can do that. So, this has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. You've heard several important topics, some interesting facts and tidbits, and we hope that you have a great week. And thank you so much for tuning in. Check out our Facebook page of our own. We have Old Mole Variety Hour Facebook page. Like us, and you will get segments of this show downloaded right there onto your feed. Magic of technology. All right, everyone. Have a great week.
KVU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Unjust Treatment. The Portland police killing of James Chassie on February 24th, 7 p.m. at the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Community Room in Aloha. The film Alien Boy, The Life and Death of James Chassie, will be shown and followed by a question and answer session with Jim Chassie, father of James Chassie Jr. Again, that's Unjust Treatment, the Portland police killing of James Chassie on February 24th. 7 p.m. at the Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue Community Room, 20665 Southwest Blanton Street in Aloha. More information can be found at kvu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KVU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Becoming Dr. Ruth, produced by Triangle Theater. Starting February 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza at 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Becoming Dr. Ruth tells the story of the outrageous and iconic Dr. Ruth Westheimer and the journey she took from fleeing the Nazis to her struggle as a single mother to coming to America and becoming a renowned sex therapist. Again, that's Becoming Dr. Ruth, produced by Triangle Productions, from February 5th through the 28th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And
and you are tuned to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Chris Andre's Air Cascadia coming right up. And that is followed at 10:15 by Locus Focus. Today with host Barbara Bernstein, she speaks with Julia DeGraw, who is the organizer with Food and Water Watch, about the campaign to keep a Nestle's bottled water plant out of the Columbia Gorge. And today at 11 is Disability Awareness. And at 11:30 on the radio scene, Andrew Geller interviews French lawmaker Laurence Abbé, who made history last month when her law regulating public exposure to radio frequency radiation was adopted. So do stay tuned to KBOO all day. And if you are not a member, become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.